Today in Studio 360, David Cronenberg. The filmmaker who shocked and thrilled us with The Fly, The Dead Zone, and A History of Violence takes a surprising turn. His new film is about Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, and a patient suffering from hysteria.
My father lost his temper all the time. He was always angry with me.
It is so disturbing to watch and makes you so uncomfortable that we decided to tone it down.
And later this hour, a modern psychologist whose career was inspired by the early days of punk music.
I was going to listen to everything differently. It just kind of opened my mind to music and art being much more than technical skill.
And we'll hear how a new bill in Congress would change what you can watch and hear on the web. I'm Kurt Anderson. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Descendants from director Alexander Payne and starring George Clooney. Now playing in selected theaters, opens everywhere Wednesday.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, I'll talk with David Cronenberg, who's made some of the strangest films ever. In the new one, all the horror plays out in the mind of an early psychoanalysis patient, played by Keira Knightley.
What I said to Keira was, this woman is basically trying to speak unspeakable things. She's trying to confess to certain things in her life. It's words trying to come out, and then the rest of you trying to stop those words from coming out.
But first, for as long as there's been a World Wide Web, there's been a giant unresolved cultural and legal issue. All those millions of songs and videos and TV and movie clips we all look at and listen to every day for free, somebody owns each one of them. And now in Congress, they're trying to tame the Internet's Wild West in a big way. This week, the House Judiciary Committee held hearings on the Stop Online Piracy Act, a version of which the Senate Judiciary Committee has already passed. The legislation would make sites that merely host content, like YouTube, owned by Google, liable for any and all unauthorized stuff, and actually prevent American web users from going to foreign sites that host swiped or bootlegged material. Robert Levine thinks the tech companies have gotten away for too long with freeloading off the culture business. He's the author of the new book, Free Ride: How Digital Parasites Are Destroying the Culture Business and How the Culture Business Can Fight Back. Robert Levine, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much.
So, briefly, even though you have a dog in the fight, what does the Stop Online Piracy Act mean for each side in the fight?
On the content side, it would give content companies tools to disrupt piracy sites, whether that means stopping credit cards from working with them or stopping search engines from listing them or even in some cases taking them down from the Internet altogether. Obviously, technology companies hate this because it would give them some responsibility for who they're doing business with, which right now they don't have at all.
So we know that the movie studios and the record labels support this act, SOPA, as it's called. What about actual content creators as opposed to content owners, subsidizers, distributors? Are artists and filmmakers and musicians, to the degree they've declared themselves, supportive?
I think so. If you look at the organizations those people are in, such as the Directors Guild of America, ASCAP, and BMI, which, you know, are collecting societies, artists seem behind it, but the creators who object to it don't seem to completely understand what it will do. There's a lot of hysteria that it will put people in jail and make YouTube impossible, but there's certainly reason to criticize it as being broad in some ways, but the idea that it's going to bring about fascism seems a little... there's this idea that goes back to the mid-90s that you can't enforce any laws on the internet, that it's sort of this libertarian free state. And people still have this attitude.
And so your reply to them is that that may have been not a bad idea 15 years ago, but at this point it's just no longer reflects reality?
What technology companies see as onerous regulation, I see as enforcing my rights. And they're certainly free to object to that, but there's two sides to the issue. And this idea that the internet should exist in a special category of law enforcement, there's really nothing to that.
Right.
So when you see people saying we need to protect this cultural vitality on the internet, I certainly understand that. When you hear people turning that into a legal argument, it's pretty hard to take that seriously. You know, I just saw this great thing. The woman who runs ChillingEffects.com was talking about how terrible this bill was. But what she forgot to mention is that Chilling Effects receives a lot of its funding from Google. And also that the idea of taking down your own work from the internet if someone's infringing on your copyright, no court has ever considered that a chilling effect. No court anywhere in the world. And this woman's a law professor at Harvard.
Are the horses so far all out of the barn that there's no good way to reinstate traditional law in copyright and intellectual property at this point?
Well, there's two things. First of all, I think you have to separate the cultural vitality on the internet, what's called the remix culture, from pure and simple copyright infringement. I use my book as an example because I'm a relentless self-promoter. I'm not that concerned about who controls my book in 2050. If you want to make a remix of my book involving zombies, go for it. I hereby grant you, you know, if you want to make a film of my book involving zombies or a TV show, even a song that mixes my book and zombies, you are free to do so. But that's not really what we're seeing here. What I've seen here, I see no zombie remixes. I see copies of my book on file sharing sites in Brazil.
Yep.
Now, if someone downloads my book without paying for it, I'm obviously disappointed. It hurts my ability to make a living. I'm not fuming mad. But that's not what we're seeing. What we're seeing is people starting a business based on my work. And that's what I object to.
Which is why in the subtitle of your book is Parasites. And from the beginning, of
right.
course, the web has been all about a kind of symbiotic relationship in some ways between various kinds of parasites, remoras, call them what you will, and these other creatures in the digital ecology. And you're just saying that the parasites have gotten too big and fat and are as large as the other creatures they're feeding off of.
To continue the trope, that's a danger to the whole ecosystem. If you look at YouTube, of the 10 most popular videos in YouTube history, 8 of them are by major label artists. 3 of them are by Justin Bieber alone. I think the skateboarding bulldog and various political uprisings are each important social phenomenon, but I don't think that's a business. The business of YouTube rests a lot on professional work. The business of the Huffington Post rests on professional work. The internet, if you look at what people do on the internet, it is overwhelmingly consuming professional content in a way that pays the creators a lot less than it did before.
Right. Now, the Stop Online Piracy Act, if it passes Congress, will it be, in your view, better than nothing? And will it be effective in doing what it intends to do?
I don't think the point is to eliminate copyright infringement, which would be almost impossible. I think the idea is to make copyright infringement really inconvenient. So people just say, oh, my God, I'll just buy it.
So it's the iTunes principle. Once iTunes existed, it was easier for my children to pay a dollar to buy a song than it would be to steal the song.
Yeah, and people say, well, don't you think you ought to make legitimate commerce easier instead of making piracy harder? And my answer is always, you need to do both. Because what really makes people act is the difference between them.
Rob Levine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rob Levine writes about media, technology, and pop culture. His new book is called Free Ride: How Digital Parasites Are Destroying the Culture Business and How the Culture Business Can Fight Back. Coming up, nobody's got more cred in the indie film world than David Cronenberg. In fact, he might even have more cred than he really wants.
I'm still trying to sell out. It's just there's nobody wanting to buy.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Descendants from director Alexander Payne and starring George Clooney. Now playing in selected theaters, opens everywhere Wednesday.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. David Cronenberg is best known for horror movies and thrillers like The Fly, The Dead Zone, Naked Lunch, and A History of Violence. They tend to be violent and gory, but they're also unmistakably personal films that make you think while you're squirming in your seat. His new movie surprised me. It plays like a straightforward period drama. A Dangerous Method is based on the real case of Sabina Spielrein, a patient of Carl Jung who became his lover. The film stars Keira Knightley, Michael Fassbender as Jung, and Viggo Mortensen as Sigmund Freud.
All I'm doing is pointing out what experience indicates to me must be the truth. And I can assure you that in 100 years' time, our work will still be rejected. Columbus, you know, had no idea what country he'd discovered. Like him, I'm in the dark. All I know is I've set foot on the shore, and the country exists.
I think of you more as Galileo, and your opponents as those who condemned him while refusing even to put their eye to his telescope.
In any event, I've simply opened a door. It's for the young men like yourself to walk through it.
I'm sure you have many more doors to open for us.
And David Cronenberg is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
So this is not a archetypal David Cronenberg movie. It's highly realistic period drama with no real violence, no non-consensual violence, and no blood spilled. What attracted you to the story?
Well, of course, I don't really know what an archetypal Cronenberg movie is.
Oh, yes, you do.
I don't really. I know what people say it is. That's not the same thing. And speaking of archetypes, of course, you're then talking about Carl Jung, so that's very appropriate.
Even though you profess not to think of what is a David Cronenberg movie or not, it seems to me your career falls in two phases. There's the early phase of people with their heads blowing up and having psychic powers. And then there's the more recent realistic phase of Eastern Promises and A History of Violence and this.
No, it's really a matter of how you attack the question of what is the human condition and what is a human being and how is life lived and all of those questions. And that's what I use cinema to explore that.
Well, and with this film, there is, a seamlessness in that in films like Dead Ringers, there were the doctor-patient relationship and The Brood, which even your first film, which I haven't seen, this short film that you made was about a patient and
a psychiatrist.
And a psychiatrist. Right. So this has been a motif of interest to you all along.
Well, I'm interested in scientists and doctors because they are interested in the physical and psychic stuff of humanness, what it is to be human. But anybody growing up in the 20th century would have to have been influenced by Freud, whether he knew it or not, just because of the incredible how it had been absorbed by the zeitgeist and And in terms of our speech, you know, ego and it and unconscious.
And every Woody Allen movie.
And every Woody Allen movie, too, yes. And I must say that Freud did not anticipate someone being going into analysis for 40 years. For him, it was a few sessions and you're out. So that's a modern sort of perversion of Freud's approach to what it was. I mean, he really thought, you come to me with a problem, I help you figure it out, and then you're out in the street again. You know, not 50 years later, we have a relationship still.
There are some terrific performances in this film, especially Keira Knightley, I think. And I want to play a clip from early on in the film when she's the patient of Carl Jung and being examined by him, played by Michael Fassbender.
Have you any idea what may have brought on these attacks you suffer from?
Humiliation and... Any kind of humiliation, like I can't bear to see it, and it makes me feel nauseated. I start pouring with sweat, cold sweat. My father lost his temper all the time. He was always angry with.
That's Keira Knightley and Michael Fassbender in A Dangerous Method. So did you give direction to her of, here's how I want you to perform this crazy person?
Well, of course. I'm a director. She's an actress.
And what did you say?
Well, it was a discussion that didn't just happen on the set, but it was basically, you know, we did research. Sabina came, her family brought her to the Bergholtzli Clinic where Jung was a resident. Because she was incapacitated by this disease which was called hysteria. And it's a disease that has mysteriously disappeared along with the era that spawned it. But the word hysteria comes from the Greek word that means uterus. And they really felt that this was a disease of women. In fact, they actually sometimes removed a woman's uterus to cure her of hysteria. We think of that. That seems very barbarous now, but they did it. And I can tell you, you know, we had to decide. It is so disturbing to watch these things, and it's so makes you so uncomfortable that we decided to tone it down. And it's interesting for us to hear that people still think it's too much or over the top or something, when in fact it's much less extreme than what these patients actually did.
And that diagnosis would be today?
Hysteria.
But today now, we would call it...
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what you would call it now, because it was then. I mean, there was a very repressive era for women at the time. And what I said to Keira was, I said, look, this woman is basically trying to speak unspeakable things. She's trying to confess basically to certain things in her life, sexual things, masochistic tendencies and so on. Talking about masturbation and other things that were considered absolutely unspeakable for a young lady to discuss. So I said, I think it's mostly the mouth, and it's words trying to come out, and then the rest of you trying to stop those words from coming out. So that's how we started to develop this.
And she does this extraordinary tick that makes this most beautiful young woman momentarily hideous with this forced underbite that
yes.
she keeps doing.
Yes, yes.
Was that...
Right. Well, that's what she came up with. Yeah. I mean, I said what I've just said to you, and then she said, "Well, how about this?" And that's what we started to do.
In the great Freud versus Jung battle, which you showed the beginning of, the sort of strictly scientific that Freud tried to profess versus the more mystical that Jung was about, do you come down in that ideological doctrinal battle?
Well, as I say, I mean, if the agenda is only resurrection, then I want it to be as accurate as possible. So I really feel that I've been very neutral in terms of what you're saying. You know, I mean, it's not pro-Freud.
Right,
Freud,
as a director,
anti-Jung.
But as
a person, I'm definitely much closer to Freud, because I feel that Jung became really a religious leader. I think he
King
was...
King of the hippies.
Well, beyond that, I've come to think of it in body terms, as you might imagine. I mean, One of the things that was so disturbing to his society about what Freud was saying was his insistence on the reality of the body. At a time when people wore tight, stiff collars and corsets and covered their bodies in many layers of clothes, he was talking about penises and vaginas and anuses and excrement and stuff, and it was just not acceptable. So I think because of Freud's insistence on the primal reality of the body, that we are a body to begin with and we must give acknowledgement to that, whereas I think Jung ultimately represented a flight from the body. He wanted only to talk about spirituality, spiritual realization. He talked about the collective unconscious and archetypes, all of which was all very abstract and unbodied. That's not to say, however, that Jungian therapy doesn't work for people, because I know for some people it really does. So in terms of therapies, that's a whole other thing. I mean, it's an alternate, and it depends on what kind of person you are.
But you trust science more than you trust religion.
Well, here's an interesting question. How much of a science can psychoanalysis be? Freud was desperate to have it accepted as science. And that's why he was so afraid of what Jung was doing, because it would easily be dismissed then as mysticism and religion and not science.
There's a smattering of violence in this new film you've made, but in your previous films there has been over-the-top significant violence in many of them. How do you know how to calibrate exactly how far is too far to go, how much is too much to show?
Yeah. Well, I think in general, if you ask me, I don't think there's any limit on how far you can go. That's in general. But then you're making a specific movie. And that's, once again, I bring up my old mantra of the movie will tell you what it wants and what it needs. And so for one movie where showing explicit violence would really destroy the movie, just dismantle it, and it's much better to be suggested. In another movie, showing the violence is what the movie's about. And so there's no rule. Once again, I think there are no rules. I'm very much into, you know, freedom of expression, take it to the extreme.
What do you regard as your most extreme in that context?
I don't know. I mean, you know, in a way, for some people, Crash was most violent, even though it's not because of violence that you see on screen. I don't even think there's any blood in Crash, but it's the idea of it, of what these people are doing.
And because it's realistic, unlike
that's right. Some
of your previous
films.
That's right.
But when I do have a tendency, I know, in History of Violence and Eastern Promises, that if I'm going to do a scene of violence, I want it to be real. I don't do quick cutting and make it cinematically acceptable.
No, the fights go on a long time.
They go on and they're awkward and they're messy and you see everything. You know, it's not like subliminal cutting, because I feel if you're going to do it, you might as well – you've got to do it.
Yes.
On the other hand,
no bullet time going on either.
Yeah, no, exactly. On the other hand, I could imagine a movie where you could justify that kind of approach. I just haven't made one like that.
Yeah. You, in addition to working with the same crew for many, many years, you were born and raised in Canada, live in Canada, produce your films significantly in Canada. Does not being in Hollywood affect your work, or would you be making the same films if you lived in Santa Monica?
Well, there was a time early in my career when I made my first trip to Hollywood, rented a red Ford Mustang convertible. It was really nice. It was February. It was freezing in Toronto and snowy, and it was beautifully sunny in L.A.
And driving a Mustang
with my friend Norman Snyder, who ended up co-writing Dead Ringers with me. But and it was because I thought I might have to move to L.A. to get movies made, because there really wasn't a film industry in Canada. But with government support, which I know is a evil word here, is for some people, with the government support.
Government itself is an evil word.
Yeah, there's that too. But it allowed me to stay in Canada and develop a career there. And I wanted to do that because, first of all, you can draw a lot of strength from your roots. I knew Toronto. I understood it. I had a deep background there. And Hollywood is incredibly seductive. And in those days, the only time I would read the trades, which is things like Variety and the Hollywood Reporter, would be when I was in Hollywood. And suddenly I'd be saying, wow, he got that much money? And how did he get that kind of deal?
So infusions of anxiety
every
morning?
Yeah, where did he get that distribution deal? And how come he got to make those five movies? And you'd start to want those things. And I think it would twist you, would have twisted me out of shape as a filmmaker. Whereas in Toronto, I really felt happily ensconced almost directly between Hollywood and Europe. And both of those places had huge influences on me.
In the 80s, once you became the Hollywood's new flavor of the month or the year, the decade, you were offered various movies to make, like Top Gun and other big mainstream
and
films.
And Flashdance, yeah.
And Flashdance.
Yeah.
Beverly Hills Cop.
Yes, that's true.
And you turned all those down.
I wouldn't say I was the flavor of the month ever, but after—
But you became the guy they offered those kinds of movies to.
They did. It's just I didn't disdain that. I just felt that I wasn't the right guy to do those movies. I mean, it was pretty straightforward, you know. I jokingly, but it's not really a joke, I say I'm still trying to sell out. It's just there's nobody wanting to buy, you know. I'd love to do a big budget, big Hollywood movie. In theory, I would like to do that. It would be fun to do. And you see a lot of, for example, European filmmakers, when they have a hit, they win an Oscar for Best Foreign Picture, they come to America. And they make a big budget.
Yeah, why aren't you making The Hobbit, by the way?
Yeah, well, I know Peter Jackson. He never offered it to me, even when Guillermo left. So, but I'm thinking, well, look, it's a game you know you're playing. If you're doing independent films, as I have been doing, that's one game, and you understand the rules of it. The financing is hell, but the creative part of it is heaven. You have freedom, and you can make the movie you want to make.
As a kid growing up, were there particular movies or other works of art that turned you on? Were you an Ingmar Bergman fan? Were you a Roger Corman fan? Neither of them?
Mm. Well, as a little kid, I watched, you know, Hopalong Cassidy movies, and I watched pirate movies. We used to call them sword fighting movies. Every Saturday I would, there was a little stream of like lemming-like stream of kids going to the various neighborhood theaters. And I do remember an interesting moment when across the street was a movie that showed Italian films only because the area that I lived in was becoming an immigrant sort of landing spot from mostly Sicilian Italians. And the theater was called The Studio. And it was across from my favorite cinema, which is called The Pylon. And I came out of my probably Hopalong Cassidy movie, I saw people coming out of the studio. This is in the afternoon. They were all adults, and they were weeping. They were crying. And I was shocked. I mean, a kid, to think that a movie could make grown-ups weep on the street. It was unthinkable. And I crossed the street carefully because I was really little. And I saw that it was called La Strada. It was Fellini's film. And, of course, later when I saw it, I was weeping too, you know, because it's a very emotional movie, fantastic movie. But that was my first inkling of the power that a movie could have over even grown-ups and that it wasn't just fun.
David Cronenberg, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We've got more of my conversation with David Cronenberg online, including the story of how he invented Canadian horror movies on the taxpayer's dime. You can listen at studio360.org. Five years ago, Studio 360 took on its first makeover project. We commissioned a prominent design firm to redesign Christmas. The whole thing. The trees, the wrapping paper, even the name. We went on to redesign Valentine's Day, the gay pride rainbow flag, and the board game Monopoly.
we might not change the world, but we'd at least like to put some options on the table. Last week, we asked you what we ought to redesign next, and we got some terrific responses.
My name is Kate Ahern, and I am calling from Marlborough, Massachusetts. Please, for the love of God, redesign the image of teachers. I have been teaching for 15-plus years and have had enough of what I deem apple crapple to last me a lifetime. Teaching isn't and hasn't been about chalkboards, apples, ABCs and 1-2-3s, or summer off for many, many years. Teachers tend to be high-tech with classroom interactive whiteboards, tablet computers, and Twitter accounts. We don't all wear horrible primary colored cardigans with alphabet blocks on them. Part of the reason why we can be so easily scapegoated and thrown under the truck is our branding is atrocious. Please, please redesign teachers.
My name is Aaron Krim. I live in Lawrence, Kansas. The sounds of the emergency alert system, I guess formerly the emergency broadcast system, they freaked me out since I was a kid. I live in the Midwest where tornado threats are common, so I'm subjected to this threat system frequently. Well, it sounds to me like an abused, limping, dying fax machine. It freaks the hell out of me. There's actually a section that's a personalized message. Usually a male voice will come on. It sounds to me like, I guess, a cyborg from hell that is possibly underground, maybe even under my own stairs, and then the person will instruct you further on what you're supposed to do. It's scarier than the actual emergency event that's going on, in my opinion. Help me, Studio 360. Please find some creative sound engineer or musician or multidisciplinary artist to rectify the situation.
Thanks to all of you who wrote in. We're still taking suggestions for the next big Studio 360 redesign. Tell us what you think it should be at studio360.org, and we'll present the results in a few weeks. Up next, a country music star gets an unusual tip. Invest in art, Soviet art.
To me, that's like saying, well, why don't you take a shuttle and go to the moon and cut the grass? What?
Get out on the redneck side every now and then.
Ronnie Dunn is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Yeah, she's a slick nickel, she's right on the money. I wouldn't give her up for a thousand buckle bunnies. I'm her big cat daddy, she's my little miss.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from to fit any lifestyle. Learn more at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Descendants from director Alexander Payne and starring George Clooney. Now playing in selected theaters, opens everywhere Wednesday.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Growing up during the Cold War, I never dreamed I'd live to see the end of the Soviet Union. But 20 years ago, in the fall of 1991, the USSR was already disintegrating. A hardline coup had failed in the summer, and Russians were dismantling their empire with a deadline of New Year's Eve. The Soviets had always prided themselves on their high culture, ballet and classical music and fine art. Their art world was subsidized and managed by the state. And in that socialist realist bubble, artists preserved styles of painting that the rest of the world started abandoning around 1900. As the Soviet Union broke up, a lot of those paintings found their way out of the country into some very surprising places. Julia Barton has our story.
At least twice a day, buses trundle along the streets of suburban Nashville, Tennessee. This is the Gray Line tour called Homes of the Stars.
On the corner on the left side now, here's the home for half of the biggest selling duo in the history of the country music business, Brooks and Dunn. On your left now, here's the home for Ronnie Dunn.
A white pillared mansion shimmers at the end of a long flat lawn.
He wrote their biggest selling single record himself. Boots, Scoot, and Boogie is a song written by Ronnie Dunn. Brooks and Dunn's debut album holds the record.
Country past the city limit sign, where there's a honky-tonk near the county line.
Our driver and guide, Lee Jackson, takes pride in all the esoteric things he knows about country music royalty. But some things are just too esoteric.
Well, so the deal with Ronnie Dunn is he collects Russian art.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Russian art. I'll be darned. Who would have known that? He sings all these great songs about America. You'd think he'd be bad American, would you? But there's no explaining taste.
So I'll show you my Grassama.
Okay.
It's a Tim Fall. I think it's Field of Crows. I'm not sure what the title is. I have to look. This stuff is just tucked away everywhere.
Ronnie Dunn has a mansion full of paintings by Soviet artists, all in the government-approved style of socialist realism. But they look like something you'd see in a French salon in the 1880s. He clearly loves all these works. He shows off a portrait of a bundled-up girl or the blue domes of an Orthodox church. And there's one northern landscape after another.
It's just a wheat field of crows, blackbirds. Off to the side is a horse pulling a huge wagon of hay with a guy sitting on top of it. The clouds and the sky. I like the impressionistic approach to stuff. It's a loose brush stroke. It's not so tight and literal.
So do any of these remind you of where you grew up?
Yeah, that could be Kansas or Oklahoma, easy. Yeah. And that's what has a lot to do with probably why I'm drawn to them.
Hey, up in the backwoods, down in the holler, old boy's feeling like a dog on a collar, keeping that chain pulled tight. Waiting on Saturday night.
So how did Ronnie Dunn end up with all this Soviet art? Kind of the way everything happens in Nashville. Money and word of mouth. After he hit it big in the late 90s, Dunn asked his record label president for financial advice.
Tim said, well, I'm going to tell you something that's going to sound really crazy to you. But he said, I really urge you to follow up on it. Go talk to a friend of mine, Ray Johnson, from Minneapolis. He said he's involved with Russian art, and he said it wouldn't hurt for you to get involved with that, or just take a look and at least listen to what Ray has to say. I mean, to me, that's like saying, well, why don't you, at the time, you know, why don't you take a shuttle and go to the moon and cut the grass? Like, what?
Soviet art does seem like a weird investment, but the tech bubble was bursting and the stock market risky. One day, Dunn saw the paintings and liked them. And he was intrigued by the guy who was selling them, Ray Johnson.
When you're a collector, you know, you just get involved, and I got more involved than maybe what I had ever planned.
Johnson has the modest demeanor of a Midwesterner and also the largest collection of Soviet-era painting outside of Russia. He made his fortune selling duck decoys. Then he went hunting for art in the decaying USSR.
We found a lot of paintings that would be pulled out from under a bed. There were instances where large paintings were actually folded before they were put under.
Johnson wasn't looking for dissident underground art. He was after the official communist-approved art by members of the Artists Union.
Maybe 5 to 10% of the pieces were purely propaganda, and pieces that the government thought that they could use to their advantage. But most of the work that they did for themselves and remained in their studios until people like myself came from all around the world to collect what was in the studios as opposed to just looking at what was presented by the museums.
That's how it was. If you wanted to paint, you had to give the party their cosmonauts and factories. Then you could paint your landscapes or nudes or whatever, as long as you stuck to safe subjects that made the Soviet Union look good, or at least not horrible.
I mean, the state owned everything.
Jamie Gambrell is an art writer who traveled to the USSR in the 1980s.
It owned all the so-called galleries. It owned all of the art magazines. It owned all of the stores where you could get good paint supplies, which was really only possible if you were a member of the artists' union.
Yep, you couldn't even buy real paint unless you were government approved. But when the free market came in, that system blew apart. Sotheby's held an auction in Moscow that freaked out the official artists.
We shall start at lot number 24 by Grisha Bruskin, Fundamental Lexicon, which is also a fundamental work in Soviet contemporary art. There's a lot of interest in this lot, and we shall start at £20,000.
Everybody just went, I mean, on all sides of every social and ideological divide, everyone went nuts. I mean, there was a lot of jealousy. There was also a lot of, you know, questions about, like, well, how do you know what your art is worth?
Dissident art was hot. Official art was not. So as the Soviet Union fell, a lot of paintings got shoved under beds, where Ray Johnson snapped them up at rock-bottom prices.
We know that we own a serious part of another country's Russian art history. It is a serious responsibility. And I had promised that I would start a museum for them at one point, and we had to deliver on that.
There is a banner up there. It is actually in Russian.
Johnson got his big client, Ronnie Dunn, to write a check for $3 million to help renovate an old church, and the Museum of Russian Art opened in South Minneapolis in 2005. We associate socialist art with heavy-handed excess, but the Museum of Russian Art will overwhelm you with tastefulness. Here's a portrait of the singer Leonid Utyosov, the Frank Sinatra of the USSR. He was Stalin's favorite singer. Utyosov is leaning against a full-sized mirror that shows the artist's easel, too. There's only a tiny hint in his arched eyebrow of all he'd been through as the darling of a dictator. Soviet painters were masters of what not to say. They did it through a technical and emotional restraint that's been out of fashion in the West for a long time. There is a place in America where artists have to respect a conservative system and work within tight formal constraints, but show originality and soul if they want to make it big. That place is Nashville, Tennessee. And nobody knows the balancing act better than Ronnie Dunn.
Can you read that?
Yeah, yeah.
You can?
Yeah, yeah. It's Bogdanov.
Bogdanovich?
Bogdanov. Yeah, Bogdanov Bielski.
Dunn seems to want to talk about his paintings and Russia all day, but not with his friends or fans. That would be weird.
I kind of don't want the secret out, to be honest with you, in many ways. I got to go work on my pickup, you know, change the oil in my truck outside.
Right.
I don't know anything about this art.
I can see the dark clouds building up ahead. Devil singing like a chorus of angels, messing with my head.
For Studio 360, I'm Julia Barton.
All my power, I fight the fight. As much as it feels good to us, it's just not right. Oh, I know that you belong to someone else.
At Studio360.org, you can see images of some of those paintings from the Museum of Russian Art in Minneapolis. Ronnie Dunn's first solo album, after Brooks and Dunn broke up, was released this year. It's an old story. A high school kid starts a rock band. His parents hope it's just a passing phase and that he'll grow up to become maybe a scientist. Today, in our series on science and creativity, we'll hear from a guy named Larry Rosenblum. He did start a rock band in high school, and he did end up becoming a scientist, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Rosenblum is a prominent researcher on human perception and the author of a book about the senses called See What I'm Saying. But he says he owes everything to his early days dreaming of rock and roll.
The bands that I liked at that time were Emerson, Lake & Palmer, and Yes, and Genesis. The musicians in these bands were just technically very, very skilled. It was impressive to hear people play as quickly as possible and to really show off technical skill. As kind of a pseudo-intellectual high school kid, if the music didn't kind of emphasize that and the musician couldn't show that off, we were much less interested, and we didn't really consider those true musicians, true artists. So I believe when I was a junior, it was 1978 or so, I went with one of my close friends to visit his brother at Cornell University. We told him the type of music our band was playing and the type of music we liked, and he thought it was really cute and charming, but really wanted to introduce us to what was going on in the musical world in New York and cosmopolitan areas. And so he turns down the lights and puts on this song, Marquee Moon by Television. It's very stark. It's very, very simple. It's almost kind of defiantly minimalist. By themselves, any one of the instruments really wasn't doing anything all that interesting. But as I was listening to the song, I realized that rather than trying to show off their technical skill or trying to kind of play over the other members of the band, what they were really concentrating on was working together. I knew that I was going to listen to everything differently. It just kind of opened my mind to music and art being much more than technical skill. By playing something very simple but very well coordinated with the other musicians, something powerful and passionate can come out of it. So all these guys with me in this classical rock band in high school were budding scientists. At the time, I was pretty intimidated by all these guys. They were brilliant, and they had technical hard science skills that I didn't have. And I, frankly, was wondering if this was something I was going to be able to cut. But kind of being introduced to this new style of music made me realize that there were so many ways of approaching the same type of problem. I think that my strengths that I kind of was made aware of then and started to accept then have now been my strengths as a scientist. So now I'm a college professor at a research institute, and I study perceptual psychology with an emphasis on multisensory integration and speech perception. And the way the instruments go together in this song remind me of a very famous perceptual illusion called the face-vase illusion, where you can see this figure as either two faces looking at each other or as a vase with a border on it. And we call that an ambiguous or reversible figure. And it's intentionally ambiguous. It kind of teaches one how the mind can, give multiple interpretations to the same perceptual experience. And I think that's probably intentional in the music as well. Those first chords can be interpreted as being on the first beat and the third beat, or the second beat and the fourth beat. And at the same time, they can be interpreted as being major to minor or minor to major. And when you're hearing those chords on their own without the other instruments, your brain's not sure how to interpret it. And it's not until the other instruments come in that you're given some sort of context for that. And you learn that the chords are on the second and fourth beat, and they're minor and major. And it'd be like, going back to the face-face example, putting eyes on the faces in the face-face image, and it then having a context where it's no longer as ambiguous. It now looks like two faces staring at each other. And you can hear the rhythms are the same, the bass part's the same, the backup guitar part's the same, but now in this context, it all is, you know, highlighted as conveying so much emotion. Boy, I still get the same chills listening to it now as I did the first time on that dorm room floor.
Larry Rosenblum is professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and the author of See What I'm Saying. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced our story. Did some song or an album change your life once upon a time, or a book or movie or any other work of art? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org, and we might feature your story on the air. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, comedian Tim Minchin and critic Cintra Wilson join me live in New York, along with the novelist Colson Whitehead, who has finally written the horror novel he's always dreamed of.
I basically wanted to write The Black Shining or The Black Salem's Lot. If you took any Stephen King title and put The Black in front of it, that's what I wanted to do.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.